Our keynote for tonight is Fly for Life. And as you might know, Fly for Life is one of the core themes of our convention this year. It's a fascinating area of aviation, and it is something that we're going to take a little time and explore this evening, and it is flying for the public benefit. Now, to host our discussion this evening is Miles O'Brien. You probably recognize that name as well. If not, you might be interested to know that he's an Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist. He is a third-generation pilot and an aircraft owner. You may remember the events of 9/11, and he was on the air using his knowledge of aviation to explain what was taking place in New York City and in Washington. Also known for his coverage of the space program and many triumphs in the space program, and also some of the tragedies like the loss of Space Shuttle Columbia in February 2003. He was on the air for 16 straight hours covering that story. And also a sort of side note to that, Miles was supposed to be the first journalist in space, and the loss of Columbia put an end to that program. But he's also covered some pretty interesting and exciting and uplifting stories, and that's what he's going to bring you tonight. Most recently, he and his wife have been producing documentary films, and a film that you'll see tomorrow night at Theater in the Woods, Over Africa, which will make its Oshkosh debut tomorrow evening. But right now, please join me in a very warm Oshkosh welcome for Miles O'Brien. Miles.
Thank you very much, Steve. I did that 16 hours live on television without astronaut diapers on, which was quite an experience. To paraphrase a great man, it's great to be among pilots, and it's good to be here with all of you tonight. You know, I've met some amazing people today who you're about to meet in just a little while, and one of them said to me, you know, we were talking about using aviation for the good, and I think to sum it all up, the thing that kind of ties it all together is they said that, you know, aviation is about hope. It's about hoping the number of takeoffs equals the number of landings, making sure it's about hoping that the oil cap was screwed on just properly. It's about hoping that air traffic control didn't see that altitude deviation. It's about hoping you have the NASA form in your flight bag. You know, that's what hope is all about. And it's also about hope in a much more serious way, because we all hope to be in the air, right? That's something that we all have strive for, and something that we love and we cherish. But for a lot of people, it means so much more. It means for a young child who is sick with cancer, a trip to a clinic far away from where they live, and certainly beyond the means of the parents to do in an affordable way. Or in the jungles of Central America, it means medicine, or it means a doctor, or it means that someone who's having difficulty with a pregnancy will be able to deliver a baby. Aviation is something that we love on so many levels, but I don't think we stop and appreciate how much it means to people in such a fundamental way. And that's what our guests are going to talk about tonight in just a little bit. It's all under the umbrella of this Fly for Life campaign this year. For years and years, missionary pilots have been a part of EAA. They've been coming to Oshkosh on an annual basis. But this year, there's been some added emphasis put on them. And you'll see a lot of their aircraft, and you'll see them right around Aerochelle Square. And I invite you to check out all their tents and talk to them. They're some of the most amazing, interesting people you can imagine. And we have a few of them here with us tonight. But before we bring them out, I want to bring out somebody who kind of put this all together. He is a man who spent 17 years with EAA as a senior executive. And in the true tradition of EAA, he now works for them for free. So ladies and gentlemen, I bring you Bob Warner.
Thanks. Thank you, Miles. Thank you, everyone, for being a part of this special evening of celebration of giving. You're in for a real treat tonight. As Miles said, for a number of years, missionary pilots and representatives of missionary organizations have been coming to Oshkosh. They come for the same reasons that all of us come to Oshkosh, because we have friends in aviation, we want to learn about the newest innovations in aviation, and we want to share the camaraderie that what AirVenture is all about. Also, those of us who have done public benefit flying and representatives of public benefit organizations have been exhibitors with small displays over the number of years. But last year, the idea of celebrating humanitarian aviation that's made possible by general aviation really came to life. And the Fly for Life theme for this year was created to acknowledge the generosity of pilots, the utility of general aviation, the opportunity for participation, which in fact is what EAA is all about, isn't it? And basically, as Miles said, the good works of general aviation. Before Miles introduces our very special guest for this evening, as I said, you're in for a real treat, I'd like to acknowledge an incredible planning group that we had to put this feature together this year and the participants for them and ask them to stand and be acknowledged by you. First group I'd like to acknowledge is the Mission Aviation Support Association. This is a group in the Fox Valley that's existed for 25 years and has raised money to be able to buy campsites so that they could welcome aviation missionary pilots and representatives of their organization and provide them with free food provided by the area churches and housing in Christian homes throughout the Fox Valley. And it was really born of them that came the idea for us to have this celebration this year. So I'd like to ask all the members of MASA and the support groups of MASA and the local area churches to please stand so we can acknowledge them. Thank you. The International Association for Mission Aviation is an organization that works with many organizations, training academies, universities, and four-year Christian colleges to prepare people for the missionary field. IAMA and all of their member organizations have really taken out all the stops, as Miles said, and you'll learn a lot by visiting their exhibits over by Exhibit Hangar D. Everyone affiliated with IAMA and all the IAMA organizations, please be acknowledged for participating in your planning for this year. They really brought their fan clubs along with them. Also, I'd like to acknowledge all the public benefit organizations that are here in much greater number this year than ever before, and I'm sure that'll be the case in the future. And I'd like to ask all of the representatives and people who have participated in those organizations to stand. I'd also like to ask any of you, even if you're not affiliated with public benefit organization, that have ever flown to serve other people to stand, and that means all of us that are Young Eagle pilots as well. And lastly, I'd like a special mention of the person that came the furthest to celebrate this week with us at Oshkosh. Last year, a gentleman walked into the MASA tent and said, "I think I have the oldest continuously flying airplane in the world that ever served the mission field in aviation missionary aircraft." It was flown in the mid-1930s by a Swiss pilot priest in Papua New Guinea. In fact, it was featured on a postage stamp in that country in the late 1930s. And he indeed fulfilled that desire to bring that airplane to Oshkosh this year so all of you can see it flying in the skies. Roy and Primrose Fox from Sydney, Australia, provided their aircraft to be shipped and trained and trucked all the way to Oshkosh, Wisconsin. We put it together last week. He test flew it yesterday. And you will see that airplane, a 1934 German Klemm, which is on display in the vintage area, in the skies over Oshkosh. So I'd like to thank Roy and Primrose Fox. Thank you very much. Thank you to everyone that's made this week be a special week for us. You're in for a real treat. Miles, please introduce our special guests. look forward to the conversation.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob, and thank you for thinking of me, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to meet these people who you're about to meet. And the way I'd like to do this is, well, first we'll bring them all out here, because that'll make it easier to talk to them, won't it? And secondly, love for you all to participate. We'll chat for a little while, and then I think we have some microphones out there somewhere, or somehow we'll get a microphone to you. And here are our guests. Everybody come on in. And give them a round of applause. Sitting right next to me is Gracia Burnham. Her husband, Martin, was for 17 years a missionary pilot in the Philippines with the New Tribes Mission. And you might remember her story. It's a heroic and sad story. In 2001, she and her husband were kidnapped by the Abu Sayyaf. They spent more than a year in captivity, horrific conditions, which are detailed in her book, by the way, in the presence of my enemies. They were ultimately rescued, but in the course of the rescue, the firefight, she lost her husband, Martin. And she's going to talk about what that ordeal was like, and a little bit about what their mission was all about as well. It's an amazing story of hope and triumph and tragedy as well. Next to her is Steve Saint. He didn't make that up, that's really his name. His name is Steve Saint, the missionary, who is the son of missionaries. Is it second generation or even third generation? Son, does it go back?
Second generation.
Second generation missionary, whose father, Nate, was a jungle pilot. As a matter of fact, you'll see this book if you go over to those tents near Aeroshell Square, Jungle Pilot, which is one of the many books that have been written about his story. His father was involved with a tribe in Ecuador and ultimately was killed by tribesmen, speared to death. Steve was very young at the time, grew up to follow in his father's footsteps, using aviation to continue his mission. But perhaps most ironically, most surprising, has become very close to the very tribesmen who killed his father. It's a story of reconciliation and forgiveness that is mind-boggling, really, frankly. Peter Van den Bosch, good to have you with us as well, the senior member of our crew, but I guess relative to our previous guest, you're a youngster, no problem. Peter had a very successful career in broadcasting, owned a bunch of radio stations, lived out the American dream, was a pilot, and flew between his radio stations, retired, and had the good life. Boat, house in Florida, everything we all want, right? And then in November of 1990, he was fishing and decided it wasn't enough. It was literally a voice in his head who said, you know, do something more. And he started an amazing charity that begins to address a lot of issues. Wings of Mercy, it's called. 400 pilots, 5,000 missions, taking sick kids, sick adults, more importantly, needy people who need to get to care for free, and harnessing the energy that is in this room, frankly, to do good work with airplanes. And at the end of the row here is Walt Fricke. He's in Minneapolis. He happens to head the Trojan Horseman air show team. You might have seen, or if you didn't see him, you certainly heard them arrive with the T-28s today. Had to cut short the air show component a little bit because of the inclement weather. He was flying when he was 12, got his license when he was 16, ultimately went to Vietnam, flew helicopters, was injured in Vietnam, spent a long time in the hospital, a long way from his family, and all those things in his life kind of came together with the most recent conflict in Iraq, and seeing the injuries that a lot of our brave warriors have sustained, and he put together a charity that's sort of in Peter's ilk, and as a matter of fact, he consulted with Peter a little bit before he did it, called the Veterans Airlift Command. And what they do is put injured veterans in places where they want to be, with their family, with medical care, where, look, really doesn't matter, does it, right? Wherever they want to go. As I said, you want to go, you take them to Las Vegas? He said, well, sure, why not? I say, okay, they deserve it, if that's what it's all about. They've done 1,300 people have been transported so far. Once again, all harnessing volunteers. It's a nationwide organization, and been very successful at helping out some of our heroes. So with that in mind, those are some stories, aren't they, folks? Give them one more round of applause, will you? Because I've been so impressed. I feel very lucky to be able to just sit in the stool. I'm kind of the what's wrong with this picture here. Although I did do 16 hours without astronaut diapers. But anyway, let's... Gracia... Maybe you missed that, Gracia. I'm sorry. It's a long... Anyway, it's out of context, I guess. Gracia, your ordeal... Made a lot of news, and what we saw on the news and what we saw on CNN was obviously just a very small portion of a very long story for you. 17 years in the jungle, 17 years flying, 17 years being the pilot. And we talked a little bit about what the significance of being the pilot is in a place like that. Let's talk about that a little bit. An airplane is so crucial to these people, isn't it?
Often a missionary aviator is the only white person or foreigner that missionaries out in a tribal village will see for months on end. So often the pilot just needs to go in and be an encouragement to them. The bigger picture is the pilot is the link to civilization for all those tribal people who have no one to help them if they're sick. If someone's dying in the village, he's the one that connects them with help. Martin loved what he did. I feel like he was kind of born to fly, and he got to do what he loved to do, and not a lot of men can say that, maybe.
Well, it's nice when you can combine passions in your life, isn't it? And that's what Martin was able to do. What you're saying is, though, excuse me, the pilot is kind of a rock star in a situation like that. I mean, the pecking order of people you want to see, it's the pilot and the plane, right?
For sure. The tribal people love the pilot. They all hang around him. The missionaries love the pilot. The missionary kids really love the pilot. He's the hero. He's the one that brings the peanut butter, right?
It's all about the peanut butter, huh?
Yeah.
Now, you were shaking your head, Steve. Tell us a little bit about that. You obviously have had that experience many times, and I'm sure your father did as well.
Well, I actually grew up in Ecuador, down in the jungles, the Amazon jungle. And when I found out that some people had houses with garages with cars in them next to the house, I thought that was a really cool idea because it was something brand new. I'd never conceived of that. Because next to our house, we had an airplane. And you didn't go any place in our world without an airplane. But we were at the very end of the road. So, maybe twice a day we'd see a little bus come down. But from where our house was, the rest of the world was airplane or walk.
Well, now, you were talking a little bit earlier as well about what the difference between an airplane and walking can mean on some trips. We're talking, we take for granted our interstate road system. It can mean literally months, right?
I remember there was a family that, to get into their place of ministry, this is a missionary doctor, they would start in Quito, the capital of Ecuador, and they would take a bus up over the Continental Divide, then they'd get on mule trains, and they'd take this mule train down into the edge of the jungles, and then when it got too muddy for the mules, then they would start walking, and then they'd take canoes and then walk again. And the jungles at night is cold and it's damp. And it took them on an average about 30 days to get from the capital city out to where they lived in the jungles. When my dad got to Ecuador with an old Stinson Voyager, it turned a month on the trail and in the Andes was reduced to about 8 hours in a bus and then 45 minutes in a Stinson.
45 minutes, yeah. For what was months with mules, muddy mules.
And you have to have walked a jungle trail to really appreciate an airplane.
Yeah. Well, I can only imagine. I bet you could go on and on about the deprivations of all this. You know, frankly, I mean, you guys have both tragic stories, but it there is a romance to being a missionary, isn't there?
Maybe.
Or does that go in 5 minutes after you've had grubs for breakfast?
I think it's just our job, what we're called to do. You know, maybe we think it's romantic that you interview people. It's just our job. It's what God called us to do.
It's hard to top this group, I'll tell you that. It's just their job. Great. Go ahead.
I don't have anything else to say.
Okay. All right. Let's move it down the line here, Peter. Let's talk about, we've been talking about what it's like to live in the jungle and having a calling. You had a calling too. How did that? In a different way, but you acted upon it. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I certainly did have a calling. I didn't plan this at all. My wife and I sold the business in 1983, and we thought, let's go to Europe. We did for 32 days, had the greatest vacation in our lives, and came back and got a place in Florida and had a boat up in Michigan, got a boat in Florida. And we golfed and fished and flew and went to the Bahamas and all over, and we were just living for ourselves. And in the eighth year of my, beginning the eighth year of my retirement, I was in my fishing boat with my three favorite guys. We were about 35, 40 miles southwest of Naples, Florida, in the Gulf, and the water was as calm as this right here. And I had, we just had parked the boat, and I took my line and threw it in, and for the first time in my life, now I had been a committed Christian since I was 17, and Second World War and music world that I was in, and I had never once ever experienced what I experienced that morning. I threw the line out, and I heard a voice just as clearly as I'm speaking now, Peter, there's more to life than this. And my knees start to shake. I didn't want to tell my buddies about this. I didn't say anything to my wife who was sitting over there. For 2 weeks, I wondered about this, and finally when I did tell her, she says, we've got to sell out and go home. I says, you're crazy. We've got it made in the shade here. But she isn't an arguer. She makes a statement, and that's the way it is. Well.
Oh, it's not like that at my house. Oh, no.
Anyway, a couple of days later, after dinner, we are having coffee, and I says, honey, are you sure about what you said? And she says, yes, I am. We put our place up for sale and sold out, came back to Michigan in February of 1991.
You couldn't wait till May?
No.
February.
February. And the people said,
that's a real calling, I've got to tell you.
Oh, my
that.
Goodness. I think our grandkids were happy we were home, and I think our kids were. But people said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know, and so on and so forth. And in May, I got a call from a fellow from Zeeland, Michigan, a friend of mine, that we had sort of drifted apart, but he was a pilot. And I had bought his airplane, and then he quit flying. And he says, Peter, I've been thinking about you. Why don't you use your airplane to fly low-income people that need medical treatment and do it for free?
He just thought of this out of the blue for you?
Absolutely. Ooh. And that was the third time that I felt God.
Did you get those weak knees again? Did you get the shaky knees?
No? I walked downstairs and I said to my wife who was sitting over there, I says, honey, Les Lodge just called. And this is what he said. And when I told her, here's what she did. She pointed her finger right at me and says, there's your call.
And you said, yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Right? And
where is she? Don't, where are you? Stand up.
Yeah, where
stand
are
up.
You?
Take a bow.
Stand up.
Is she there?
Was,
can we get her up the house lights? Just there she is.
Supported.
Give her,
there she
give
is.
Her a round
there
of applause.
She is. Yeah. And
she really should
she
be up
came
there.
Up with the name Wings of Mercy. I needed a name for an organization, and it's she that came up with that name. And we began, I did my first flight on July 9th of 1991.
Do you remember it?
Oh, very, very much so. There was a little, I flew two little people and their mother. They were Hispanics. The little girl was only about that tall, 18 years old, and her brother was about that tall, 21 years old. Both had aging disease and cancer. And I flew them to Rochester, Minnesota, and they got out of the airplane and got them on their way, refueled the airplane, and took off. And before I got to altitude...
You took off, but you forgot the airplane, right?
before I got to altitude, I knew where God wanted this guy. No doubt about it. And the organization has just exploded since then.
Has it been hard work, or have they come out of the woodwork, pilots wanting to help you?
Well, there were struggles at time. There were some financial problems at first, not problems, but I wanted to reimburse the pilots for their fuel. And so we did that. And I didn't have time to go out and get money. So pretty soon I was $5,000 of our money in there. And my wife says, well, how far are you gonna go? I says, I really don't know. And I went to the bank where I banked, and the manager says, hey, how's this Wings of Mercy thing going? I says, just fine. But I says, I'm $5,000 in the hole. He got a hold of the phone and he called the president of the bank, FMB in Michigan, Sealand. And I went up there to see him, and he says, well, how much money do you need? Well, I wasn't gonna say $5,000, but please, he says, tell me, how much would you like? I said, $2,000 would help a great deal.
I thought you were gonna ask for $1 million. Just go high.
And then about a week later, I would get a check from them for $2,500. But the very same day, I got a telephone call from Prince Corporation, which is now JCI, Worldwide Outfit. And I had not called on Prince. I knew Ed Prince, but I did not call on them. But he knew about us. And they asked me to come over there, and I did, and presented me with a check for $5,000. I left there, drove down the street a little bit towards our home, and I was so filled with wanting to thank my God. I pulled off the road and did so. And we have not wanted for 1 cent since.
Wow. That's something. So, wow. Walt, have you had a similar kind of experience? Is it just when you, you know, first of all, when you look at your life, always aviation, your experience in the military, the fact that you did well and were retired, it all looks obvious now that this is what you should be doing in a way, but obviously it didn't before you figured this all out. Since it's happened, has it had that sense, like Pete has had, that it's all fallen into place?
Absolutely. I mean, I wish my wife were here. If she were, she'd be sitting right over there, too. But she would say the same thing, that it's very clear that there's wind in our sails that wasn't us. It was, when I retired, I intended to take my airplane and go fly some wounded soldier from the VA hospital or his family from the VA hospital in Minneapolis. And was encouraged, actually, I was going to start an organization. And I flew to Michigan to meet Peter to ask him for advice and counsel because he had done it successfully and he was a great encouragement to me. and haven't seen him since until tonight. So this is a special deal. It got out of hand. I was going to fly Meyer. I don't think I've flown two or three missions in the last 3 years because we've got 1,000 volunteers now nationwide that do this for us. I'm busy, you know, scheduling the missions and organizing the back room, but I participate because I hear the stories from the guys that fly them, people who write me notes and say, that was the best Saturday I've ever spent in my life flying that wounded kid back to Walter Reed. And it clearly all fell into a place in a way that I could never have done.
So obviously pilots have beaten a path to your door. They find out about it through articles in the magazines and so forth. And the veterans themselves, the word is out?
Yeah, it is. I visit because I was a combat wounded, spent 6 months in a hospital. I relate to these kids. I go visit them at Walter Reed and in San Antonio, Brook Army Medical Center, Balboa Navy Hospital, and tell them about us. Military guys are kind of proud, and they want to ask for charity. One of the reasons we named it the Veterans Airlift Command, it sounds a little bit like a military organization. They pick up the phone and call us and ask for a ride, and we generally don't have trouble filling missions. We put the word out on the net, and somebody wants to do the mission. And then it, by word of mouth, it spreads through the barracks and through the Wounded Warrior Battalions in the hospital, and the families that have been served are telling their friends about it, and it's grown just like that.
So is it accurate to say if a veteran wants to avail himself of this, he can get a ride one way or another? Who's in this situation?
You know, if it's an appropriate request, if we feel it's beneficial to their healing, which, you know, visiting with their family, bringing their buddies, combat buddies that are returning to Camp Lejeune. This kid got plucked out of combat and he's in a hospital in Bethesda. The military doesn't pay to bring his buddies up to see him, but that's powerful healing. I can tell you a quick story. A young Marine was in a VA hospital in Minneapolis, polytrauma center, had a traumatic brain injury and had broken nearly every bone in his body. Was a real mess, and they had gotten him to the point where he could walk with a walker and someone holding a belt behind him one step at a time, very slowly, 10 steps, he was done. And they said they thought that's as good as he was going to get. They're going to send him home to Michigan in a few weeks to go to an extended care facility for the rest of his life. His dad called, said, his buddies are back from Iraq. Can they come and see him, would you? Because we've been flying the parents back and forth. They had a business in Michigan, couldn't get away, so we would fly them back and forth every weekend to be with him. And they asked if we could bring his buddies, and I said, absolutely. I know how important that is. He may never see them again if we don't do this. So we flew two plane loads of his friends over two weekends. And I used to go visit him in the hospital because he's right in Minneapolis. And I saw him taking these few halting steps with a walker, having been told this is as good as it's going to get. 2 weeks after his buddies came to see him, we flew him home for his transfer back to Michigan. He got off the airplane and walked 100 yards without a walker with his girlfriend on his arm. And I saw him last summer, and he's back to his military physique. I mean, this kid has recovered. And I believe it had a lot to do with reconnecting with his buddies. Those are now family members in a way that those who haven't served in combat don't understand, but reconnecting with his buddies did it for him.
Wow. It's hard to imagine how gratifying that must be for you.
My daughter tells me if we're having a bad day, if I'm not in tears by noon, and don't have her in the same place. I mean, because that's exactly right. It's actually healing for me. For a lot of guys that fly are my age, are Vietnam veterans or military veterans, and it's meaningful to them to do this. A lot of our pilots are ex-military, and it's for Vietnam especially, where, you know, we kind of got the thanks for your trouble, you know, when we came home. This is a way for us to ensure that this doesn't happen again to another generation of our finest, that they're treated with respect and dignity. If you can imagine going through the airport security to fly in a commercial airline and having your artificial limbs swabbed down for explosive material and treated like a criminal, 30 minutes going through security. I've traveled with these kids, and I've been through security and had to stand there and wait for them to get a kid with five rows of ribbons on his chest, wearing his dress green uniform, with two bilateral amputee, spent 30 minutes being wanded down by the security agents in uniform. And it's humiliating. And then when we fly him,
it's a scandal. It shouldn't happen. Shouldn't happen. I mean, really. And obviously, there wasn't anybody offering you a ride when you came back from Vietnam. So this is a great thing you're doing.
We're blessed to do it. We really are.